Hello and welcome to the Autosport Podcast. I'm your host, Alex Kalanorkas. Welcome to our latest episode where we'll be discussing the latest news in the world of Formula One. Joining me to do that are two of my regular guests and travelling companions. Very much looking forward to the day we can hit the road again, hopefully when the current awfulness of the pandemic has eased up. First up, it's Autosport's F1 reporter, Luke Smith. How are you doing, Luke?
Yeah, not too bad, thank you, Alex. It's been another sort of strangely busy week in the world of Formula One. There's lots of sort of small bits of news just popping up here and there, really. So we're only sort of like 3 weeks removed, I guess, from the, well, a month now from the end of the season, but things are still ticking over. It's quite interesting. So good to chat about some more news this week.
Indeed, yeah, it really does not seem like that long ago at all that it was the Abu Dhabi Grand Prix in the end of 2020. I was thinking of that earlier on this week. I was like, oh yeah, that really was just a few weeks ago. Seems bizarre. I guess that's just the natural way the human brain tackles the changing years. Right, well, I'll stop rambling and introduce my next guest, which is motorsport.com's F1 editor, Jonathan Noble. How are you, John? How are you finding this January of Januaries in the pandemic? How does it compare to the usual F1 news cycle at this time of year?
Yes, you've got this kind of disconnect between the kind of the horrible stuff that's going on outside in the real world, and F1 still operates to the kind of the same buzz and the same rhythm and the same kind of reflections on last year and anticipation for next year. But as Luke says, it seems to be a bit busier than it normally is at this time of year. But I wonder if we're going to just have, because the season's finished so late, whether we're going to have a bit of a lull in February where we're kind of trapped between the last season was quite a while ago and the teams aren't quite ready to speak enough yet ahead of the new season.
But first of all, we're going to be discussing three dedicated topics on this new edition of the podcast, which is part of a new weekly offering we're going to be doing leading up to the start of the new season, just chatting through the news and events of each week. And our first topic for discussion today is something actually we chatted about quite regularly last year, but haven't had the chance to tackle in depth on the podcast over the Christmas and New Year break, and that's Red Bull's driver lineup. Now, of course, by now, you'll know that Sergio Perez has been signed to partner Max Verstappen, while Alex Albon, his teammate last year and sort of the second half of 2019, has been made the team's reserve driver. Albon will also compete in the revamped DTM category in 2020, where his F1 commitments allow, that is. And we understand he'll be driving a Ferrari 488 GT3 alongside Red Bull Junior Liam Lawson. How big a hit do you think being demoted back to reserve driver and out of Formula One in terms of racing for at least a whole calendar year, how big a hit is that to his F1 ambitions?
Yeah, it's huge. And I think that it is so different to when we saw both Pierre Gasly and Daniel Kvyat meet a similar fate when they were obviously both sent back to Toro Rosso. And that gave them at least the chance to kind of rebuild their career and keep racing in F1, keep sort of on that radar. Christian Horner made clear a few weeks before the decision and the end of the season that if Albon didn't get a Red Bull seat for next year, he would be out of F1 completely and on the sidelines. And although the team has said he's going to be undertaking an extensive testing and development program with a view to 2022, it doesn't really give him much of a chance to actually sort of show what he can do and really strike back and perform. And that's something that both Kvyat, particularly when he made his second comeback with Toro Rosso, scoring that podium at Hockenheim, and obviously Pierre Gasly to an enormous degree right the way through 2020. They were both able to, I guess, sort of rebuild and get these big results that made everyone go, oh, okay, well, they're still decent, they're still performing. And the issue for Albon is that he doesn't really have that opportunity. And going into a very sort of new DTM series with the GT3 rules that they're adopting, but ultimately he's not raced in tin tops ever, I don't think. So I think that's going to be sort of a big change for him. And I think it's just, it is a real, real big setback. And I think that for Red Bull, I think they've just got to, I don't really see where he goes from here, to be honest. And I think it's, although it's useful that, okay, he's going to be sort of playing such a big role in that 22 development, I think that unless Perez has an absolutely stinking year in that seat, realistically, are Red Bull going to be looking at Albon as someone to come back for 2022? Because I think either way, either Perez goes beyond the initial one-year contract he signed, or they'll look further into their junior program if Yuki Tsunoda has an amazing first year with AlphaTauri, if someone like Yuri Vips can really stand out, I don't know. But for me, Albon just seems in this weird sort of purgatory state right now, where it's like, I don't know where he's actually going to go.
Yeah, it's a weird one, isn't it? In terms of the role he's been given with Red Bull being the reserve driver, you imagine obviously he'll be at all the Formula One races. The sort of the news that he'll be going into the DTM will be very much, he'll do the races that are not clashing with Formula One, in the coming season. I don't think we've had a DTM calendar. Probably should have looked that up before we start recording the podcast, but maybe I can do that, seeing as I've got my computer handy. But it's more that you know, he's going to be with the team a lot, whereas Red Bull historically has used its backup drivers on race weekends back at base to be testing new parts, to be helping out with the setup and just generally helping out the F1 team, which is why, you know, their junior drivers after a little while tended not to be placed in GP2 and what is now F2, because they would be running at the same time. So Albon, you know, I'm sure he'll be working very hard at the factory when it's not a race weekend and will be contributing to the team's efforts there. But you could see that as a bit of a sort of a strain. He's not able to help out completely if he's just there twiddling his thumbs on weekends where he's not needed as the reserve. Now, of course, the flip side of that is, as we saw with Nico Hülkenberg, and indeed, I think it was Albon who had an inconclusive test at the Nürburgring, although it was later found that he was negative for COVID-19, that Red Bull alerted Hülkenberg that they might need him. In fact, of course, he ended up driving that weekend in place of Lance Stroll. But the news today that Charles Leclerc has tested positive for COVID, Lando Norris, of course, has had it recently, and obviously the drivers last year at Racing Point that missed races, and of course, Lewis Hamilton. So there is the chance that he could be racing next year, which is not guaranteed. So, John, can you see him getting back to Formula One after, you know, considering everything that Luke has explained and the sort of the strange position he's now in at Red Bull?
I think it's better to have one foot in the door than to have had the door completely slammed in his face. So, you know, sure, it's not ideal that he won't be racing, but I think keeping sharp and keeping him with the team, being in that reserve standby role will be especially important. I think as we see this kind of the coronavirus develop, we get these new strains. I think we're seeing it seems to be spreading much easier. So, you know, where the precautions that may have worked last year may not work this year, it may be that, you know, as we go in, that we will see kind of more flash infections. We had five drivers now have been taken down with it since the pandemic started. So that likelihood is, you know, the others aren't all going to escape. And I think Ross Brawn mentioned last year, it's quite interesting that out of all the different kind of categories in the paddock of team bosses and mechanics and engineers and journalists and TV people and catering crews, actually the drivers as a percentage have been amongst the highest infected, which is quite an interesting thing. So I think Alex does have a chance. You know, we'll rest a lot on what Sergio does alongside Max. It will rest a lot on what Tsunoda and Gasly do if Gasly stays within the Red Bull camp for 2022. So I think it's better to have an option and be considered. And as we saw in Nico Hülkenberg, you know, 12 months ago he was out of Formula One and pretty much forgotten. And then huge hype around him in the middle phase of last year when he came back and did a pretty good job in that Racing Point. So in F1, you're only ever as good as your last race. And I think if Alex, you know, gets the opportunity to do a race, if he does well in that race, then suddenly his reputation's back sky high again and he'll be a contender. So he's got that chance, and I think that's the main thing.
Indeed, one of us even argued Nico Hülkenberg to be into Autosport's top 50 drivers of the year for 2020, but was outrageously overruled because apparently just doing two races, although it should have been three, of course, not enough. But there we go. Not that I'm bitter about that or anything. And I can just confirm there is a 9-round, 18-race DTM calendar that has been announced. I won't bother going through the clashes because, as we'll come to later, any motorsport calendar at the moment is just completely, you know, there's no guarantees that races are going to be happening on any set dates at the moment because of the nature of the pandemic. Luke, it's interesting just thinking about something John mentioned there about, you know, Albon retaining his links. But where does he come back? You think sort of logically it would be with AlphaTauri, but they've just signed Yuki Tsunoda, Pierre Gasly. Red Bull keeping hold of him very, very tightly. But there's a whole set of intriguing circumstances about what could happen for all three drivers' careers if we think about Albon, Tsunoda and Gasly because of the like Honda leaving Formula One at the end of next year. Yeah, but would it be logical to expect Albon, if he does come back, to come back at the lower, at the junior team rather than the main Red Bull squad?
I think it's definitely an option. I think that, hypothetically, say Tsunoda has a very good first season and Red Bull kind of think, let's push him straight up to Red Bull, the senior team for his second year, a bit like they did with Gasly, then I think that would open up a possibility. But the other thing is you've got the other Red Bull juniors who are obviously sort of looking to step in as well. Yuri Vips, Liam Lawson, they're both going to be in F2 this year with Red Bull backing. So they're both in that consideration. But I think that I think the fact that AlphaTauri is now becoming more of a sister team rather than a B team, it's kind of, its purpose is no longer to get the next Red Bull driver on the grid, basically, because ultimately, we've seen with the signing of Perez that Red Bull have had a bit of a break with that mentality of we can only hire from within our own driver pool. I spoke to Franz Tost few weeks before the end of the season. We spoke about sort of Gasly and his future, and he said that he doubts that Red Bull would let Gasly go easily, that for all the ideas of him maybe stepping outside of their pool in the future, that he just doesn't think Red Bull would want to do that. He said that AlphaTauri really wants to build the team around Gasly, like design the car to things that suit him, so have him as the team leader. So I think that it really depends. I think that if Tsunoda were to get that opportunity to maybe go up to Red Bull, which actually is probably looking a little bit more realistic right now than Gasly, just because of how Gasly is positioned with AlphaTauri, then maybe Red Bull might say, let's get Albon back in there and give AlphaTauri two very, very good drivers. And I think that Alex has proven on his day that he really can perform, and he excelled in the AlphaTauri environment. So, I think that's maybe more likely, but there's just so many moving parts to it, as you say, like with Honda leaving as well. Tsunoda, Rebel have always said it's nothing to do with Honda that he's in that seat. Obviously, he's such a big Honda protege that it's really hard to think that it's not something to do with it. So I think, it's going to be really fascinating. I think that we're already sort of thinking about silly season foot for next year, and I think that how that sort of driver chain between Perez, Gasly, Albon, Tsunoda and the other Red Bull juniors moves, I think that's going to be really, really fascinating.
I'm going to ask you both shortly to give your opinion on how you think Sergio Perez will get on alongside Max Verstappen next year. But John, just before we do that, what does this latest development in terms of the second Red Bull seat say about Red Bull's driver program? Both of the up-and-comers that have come in since Daniel Ricciardo left and went to Renault haven't fared very well. It's been quite painful at times to watch Gasly and Albon racing in that seat and not doing particularly well considering how quick the car is. But also at the same time, you know, is it necessarily a young driver program problem, or is it a case of it's just so difficult for anyone to slot in a car that's difficult to drive in a team that's built and catered around an absolute superstar in Max Verstappen? And it's something else. There's another element that Red Bull haven't quite got right, and that they're aiming to tweak by bringing in an established driver in Sergio Perez.
Yeah, I think part of the problem is just the poor timing in some respects that. You know, you want a young driver program, but you also want the time to get these youngsters up to speed and prepared and iron out the mistakes. And you look at what Mercedes have done with George Russell, you know, a structured three-year plan and sticking to the three-year plan. Toto's been quite clear that, you know, this is the length of time it probably takes to properly get up to speed, to properly understand the strengths and weaknesses. And even after, you know, how brilliant George was in Sakhir last year, Toto still says that, you know, he needs to iron out mistakes and get rid of the weak days, because when you are thrust into a car at the front of the grid, there's no excuse. People will be on your back if you make the kind of mistakes that George made at Imola this year. So the problem for Red Bull is that they've had vacancies to fill that have kind of been forced upon them. So, you know, Gasly was probably promoted too quickly, not enough time in the junior thing, then didn't deliver because he's up against someone as brilliant as Max Verstappen. So then they were forced to hand Alex probably too early as well. So then you're thrust up too fast into a situation where there's pressure to deliver straight away. You don't have 3 years to get up to speed at Red Bull. You've got to deliver in the first year. So I think it's probably circumstance, which is why, you know, hats off to them for being pragmatic about taking Sergio Perez, that, you know, they've put the competitive reasons as the primary force behind that decision, because they need someone who acts as Max Verstappen's rear gunner. I don't think there's any expectation that, you know, Sergio is going to come in and is going to blow Verstappen's doors off and become a superstar and win six races and fight for the world championship. I think they still see him playing not necessarily a firm number two support role, but I still think they expect Max to be the team leader on pace. But they want Sergio to be the disruptor and disrupt those Mercedes, cause them trouble, and that will help Red Bull in the championship fight.
And Luke, do you think he'll be able to do that? How do you think he'll get along in terms of... because Red Bull really just need him to be there or thereabouts with Verstappen. They just need to have a second card to play when it comes to tactics. And you know, if there is an opportunity that Mercedes let slip, that they can use both their cars to capitalise, because there have been opportunities. We think of Imola, where Hamilton had a bad start last year, and then Bottas picked up damage. With a second car, it might have been a bit easier to defeat Mercedes that day. But yeah, how do you think Perez will get on next year?
Yeah, I think he'll do grand. I think that he will be that rear gunner that Red Bull have really been lacking ever since Daniel Ricciardo left the team. And I think that it's obviously clear that the team is built around Verstappen. That car is very much sort of towards his driving style and stuff. And we saw this year how even Max struggled at points with it, but particularly Albon did. And I think that Checo stepping into that, I don't think it's going to be... Yeah, it'll take a bit of sort of time to adjust and acclimatise to it. But I think that once he gets up to speed, I think, yeah, he'll be a good match. I think that it won't be the sort of the qualifying thrashing that Verstappen has delivered his teammates over the past couple of years. I think that Perez will be a good step closer. And I think that you look at, I mean, you think of races like the 70th anniversary Grand Prix where it was all about tyre management. I mean, Perez, that's his thing. Like, he could do that brilliantly. So I really do think that when we have races like that and that Mercedes do drop the ball and are exposed, I think that it will give Red Bull much more of a chance to actually sort of take them on and compete against them. And even in Abu Dhabi, I mean, that was a race that had Verstappen not been so much quicker than the Mercedes and Mercedes been struggling so much, that Red Bull would have been in trouble because Albon was so far behind that Mercedes could have split the strategies with their cars quite easily, had this kind of pincer movement. And that's really where race wins are lost. And I think that Perez, I think he's just got the experience, he's got the pace, and I'm just really excited to see him finally in a top-line car to see what he can probably do, because it's going to be, I think, really exciting that for a driver who's sort of been one of the best in F1 pound for pound for the past sort of 5 or 6 years to now finally get the opportunity, I think it's going to be really, really exciting.
Definitely. And just, I was thinking the other day about that 2020 Emilia Romagna race at Imola after Verstappen had gone out with a puncture, where they get the safety car, Bottas gets the debris taken out of his car, and effectively you've got the two Mercedes just showing what they can do. And they just clear off. The gap at the end of the race is just staggering between the Mercedes and the rest of the field. And it really demonstrated how good Verstappen was to hang with them for most of the race and across the season. It was just like, with him gone, they were completely clear. And it also just showed again how good that W11 car was. But John, I take it then we're not expecting any Perez versus Ocon style, you know, 2017, 2018 style fireworks between Verstappen and Perez next year?
I don't think so. Although it'd be quite fun to see a bit of a bit of argy-bargy between Verstappen and Perez, because I think that would be quite feisty, I reckon. I think Perez knows kind of the scenario he's going into there. I think he knows he's not, you know, when Ocon came in against Perez, he had a point to prove, and you're a youngster trying to make seal a reputation. You want to show that you're also no pushover. Whereas I think Perez is. You know, much in a different phase of his career, much more grown up. He knows the job he's got to do. He knows he's got a golden opportunity to deliver perhaps his most successful season in Formula One. So I think they'll work well as a team, even if, you know, I think they will be racing hard at times.
Well, let's move on to our second topic for this podcast, which is probably, unfortunately, going to be a regular feature for the podcast ahead of the start of the season, and no doubt, indeed, when it finally gets underway as well, given all the dreadful uncertainty we currently find ourselves living through. And that is changes that have been made to the 2021 calendar. Now, the three of us spoke last week about the expected postponement of the Australian Grand Prix, and that has now happened, with the race pushed back from being the season opener to the 21st of November. The Emilia-Romagna race will return at Imola, and that will be the second round of the season, currently slated for the 18th of April. Luke, can you please give us the full story on the latest calendar shufflings, including what that means for pre-season testing? And are there any further changes predicted at this stage?
Sure. So, as you said, last week we discussed that the Australian Grand Prix was looking set to be postponed. We then had our colleague in China, Frankie Mao, broke on Saturday that the promoter of the Chinese Grand Prix was asking for a postponement of the race as well as the second half of the season. F1 put in a rejig that was announced this week and confirmed that Bahrain would be the new season opener. So as a result of that, pre-season testing has also been moved to Bahrain as well. We're still waiting for an official announcement on that, but all of the teams are now agreed on a date, so that's going to be taking place from the 12th to the 14th of March, which is just inside the sort of right window for them to within the sporting regulations before the start of the season. And then we've also got a TBC slot, which was originally set for Vietnam initially. That is moved to May 2nd, and that is set to be the Portuguese Grand Prix at Portimão, although they're still waiting for an official announcement of that. And we've actually had this afternoon that travel from Portugal to the UK has been suspended by the British government. So it's factors such as that that when F1 are kind of planning this out, you can't really be too firm in terms of what's happening. So I think really we're looking at, we've just got to take it week by week and month by month and just see what the sort of, what happens. It is obviously going to be the flyaway races that are sort of more having more question marks over them. I understand that an idea of two races at the Circuit de Catalunya in Spain, that's been suggested as a possible option if Monaco weren't able to go ahead. And then that back end of the calendar, I mean, there's a lot of races. It's what, 9 races in 11 weeks, 3 triple headers all sort of going in a line. So I think that's going to really stretch the whole paddock to its absolute limit. But it is all very much a case of, will that actually happen? Like, will these flyaway races happen? Will the vaccine that is being rolled out across the world to varying degrees, how much of that will help the situation? And yeah, I think F1, they're already showing that they've learned the lessons from last year, that they are able to get these races in, such as Imola, such as Portimao, which were good backups last season. And I think that they'll know that European races such as Austria, Silverstone, Hungary, for example, they'll know how to execute those even under very tight restrictions with the pandemic. So yeah, so that's how we're looking right now. I think really, realistically, we can look at sort of that first, I guess the first 2 races, that's all that we're sort of like firmly saying right now is absolutely dead set to happen. But yeah, it's going to be, as you say, a story that we sort of follow over the coming weeks and months. And a lot really just depends on how various countries fight the pandemic and what the levels of transmission are really across them.
Indeed. Although you mentioned 2 races in the Circuit de Catalunya, Barcelona, I mean, they're going to have to do something drastic to spice up the 2 events, a bit like they did between the 2 races at Silverstone last year. Because the Spanish Grand Prix in 2020, looking back at it for the season review, the Mercedes lapped everyone up to 3rd place. Yeah. Like it was just staggering. Just looking back, like, oh yeah, they did that, didn't they? God, it was tremendous. So they're going to have to.
I don't know if they could maybe go with the old, take out the chicane at the final corner. I don't know if that they're still allowed to do that. If they could theoretically have like the old Circuit de Catalunya was with that sort of final sweeping double right hander. I don't know. Maybe something like that. I don't know if that's got a grade 1 license, but.
I've definitely played games where you make a corner halfway down the main straight and just cut off half the track. So maybe they could do a bit like the Sakhir Grand Prix, although of course you mentioned they have to be licensed by the FIA, but yeah, just something to spice that particular event up. But John, the other thing I wanted to talk about in terms of this topic, and Luke has mentioned it already, is that the reshuffle has now created 3 triple headers for this year, which is currently the Belgian, Dutch and Italian races, Russia, Singapore and Japan, and then the USA, Mexico and Brazil before going to Australia and then ending up in the Middle East again to end the season. Now, there's a high chance that many of those will be changed or even outright cancelled, considering, you know, the problems in the pandemic. Luke mentions Portugal being added to, you know, the flights being stopped in terms of coming to the UK. That's specifically because of a new variant coming out of Brazil. And obviously the close links between those 2 countries, the UK wants to try and restrict or at least keep an eye on how that variant would potentially spread to this country. So that's what that's all about. But what was your reaction to the way it's currently been arranged, given how demanding F1 found such tightly grouped runs of events last year, and it had previously ruled out using triple headers ever again after having won in 2018?
Yeah, I mean, I know there's a lot of criticism of what F1 had done with the calendar with this bunch of triple headers, but I've always been convinced that this calendar has always been viewed as kind of a staging post, that it's never their belief that this calendar would happen as it was. So when we had a calendar last year, some people were surprised, you know, how committed they were to running 23 races. But the options at that stage were simply you either publish a list of 23 races or you publish no races. And if they'd published no races, it would have looked bad for the sport. It would look bad for sponsors. It would have been bad for the teams. They'd have been criticized for saying, why can't you have a calendar? This is ridiculous. So they've got to project these races and have an outline plan, but I think, as Luke says, the pandemic seems to be moving quite quickly. Developments, you know, can happen quite quickly. You know, the Brazil variant, I think, has only been talked about within the last 24 hours, and suddenly governments have moved quickly and travel banned. So we're gonna keep having these trouble, even if the vaccine's rolled out by kind of late summer, autumn time. I don't think that's going to be a clear route for having races back in cities or races in locations that can't be locked down. But I think the confidence that F1 has with the way things worked last year, especially the biosphere approach they had in Abu Dhabi, means I think we can get a calendar. I think it will have to be quite flexible. I think it will not have, won't be able to go to cities that can't be controlled quite well. So I don't think the calendar, that second half calendar, is going to turn out anything like they've published. And I think they've crammed them in because I think they know that races are going to have to come out. So they know they're going to have to give flexibility, and it just gives them that freedom. So, you know, if you lose six races, that's still a 17 race calendar. That's still plenty enough for an F1 season. But I think in the end, we're going to end up with a lot more European races, maybe, you know, some back-to-back doubleheaders again, repeats like we had last year, and we'll lose some of the flyaways into cities. But I think we'll get something, but I don't think it's going to be anything like what we've got at the moment.
If that European triple header that's currently on the calendar at the moment, in sort of the back end of the summer going into the autumn, going to from Spa to Monza via Zandvoort. John, I know you don't fancy this from previous chats we've had off the podcast, but do you fancy a road trip bringing in all those classic tracks?
Oh, hell yeah. I'd be well up for that. That'd be well cool. Yeah, no, definitely. Let's do that. So, well, we start at Spa, pop to Zandvoort, down to Monza back. Yeah, we could do that, I reckon.
Good. Well, I mean, I've had chats that should mean I shouldn't be finishing quite so late on a Sunday night when it comes to my workload. So, you know, might be able to set off a bit earlier, and I might be in a better mood for a change. But so, nice. You know, I can
maybe even rope in Stuart Codling and put his 7 years in the catering industry to good use as well.
We should come on to our final topic to discuss on this podcast, which is that earlier this week, F1 moved to confirm again its commitment to introducing the new rules package for 2022, which has, of course, already been delayed by a year thanks to the pandemic. John, can you just explain why it felt the need to do that, please?
Yeah, I think it came shortly after the calendar changes. And I think there's been, you know, the fact the pandemic situation appears to be getting a bit worse around Europe has led to more uncertainty. And if you're the F1 organization, what you don't want is uncertainty. You want, you know, that these races are going to happen, that all the teams are safe, that we're pushing on forwards. And there was a story in Italian newspaper Gazzetta dello Sport suggesting the 22 rule changes would be delayed another year for 2023. But very quickly, F1 moved to clamp that down to absolutely zero chance. I think they were so firm on it because I think the teams needed assurance that they were pushing on, that, you know, heading into a season where there's a lot of work going on the 2022 cars, having to juggle that development alongside pushing on with the current cars where they can work on them. So I think it's more just about giving certainty to the situation, because sometimes in Formula One, you know, a small whisper or a small rumour or a small point of speculation, you know, can get spiral out of control. And while it may not be true, some people may think that there's some hidden agenda or massive conspiracy, and it is actually happening, and that could hurt teams. They're plotting budgets and have to operate within a cost cap. So I think they moved quickly just to nip that one in the bud and make it clear that 2022, we are getting the new cars.
Indeed. And Luke, would it be bad if F1, if it did came to pass, which obviously we're not expecting, considering all that John's explained there, would it be bad for another year without the expected revolution in terms of racing happening?
Yeah, I think we're all very keen for that to happen. And I think that was the big fan outcry that we saw on the morning that report emerged before F1 had responded with its own statement. It was lots of fans saying, no, like, we don't want this to continue. Like, we don't want to have another year of Mercedes dominance and everything like that. And although that obviously the cars aren't a complete carryover, so it doesn't mean that would happen. Obviously, it does sort of... Everyone is very eager for this big change and shift in the regulations to happen. And I think that things such as the budget cap and elements such as that, it's all pushing towards sort of F1's new future. And we want to see that as soon as possible, we do. And obviously, it's a very difficult situation right now with the pandemic. But we've got the budget cap starting this year, which is a very good step. And that's really good news. And I think that we just want to see these new cars as the next thing that comes in, so that we can have the more level playing field. And although the bigger teams with the better resources are still going to be ahead to begin with, I think we don't really want to delay it any further to sort of wait for this convergence that I think everyone is really hoping for. So yeah, I think it wouldn't be great if F1 was forced to delay again. So that's why it was, as John said, very good to see it so emphatic in its response and call the report wrong and say that it just wasn't going to be delayed again.
Indeed. Well, let's move on to our final, actually a bonus topic, because we are trying to keep everything to sort of, we're only going to talk about three bits of news per podcast on these sort of weekly editions that we're now going to be doing. What was your reaction to seeing the temporary winter livery? I say that, you know, doing the classic cliche of inverted commas with my fingers that the listeners won't be able to see on our Zoom call. The pictures that the Alpine team released this morning. What did you make of those pictures, John?
I was more more amazed by the fact everyone seemed to get so angry about it, that a team basically, it was a big Renault announcement today about, I think they call it Renaultution. So it's Renault's roadmap for it's kind of the Renault group cars of Renault and Alpine and Dacia kind of going forwards over the next 10 to 15 years. So, and part of that plan includes Formula One, which I think is, you know, a great thing. This is the thing to get excited about, that a company like Renault is so committed to Formula One and throwing its weight behind with the switch to the Alpine brand. And part of that, they had an Alpine car in the presentation and issued some photographs just to talk about it. This the 2020 car with you know, black colours and the tricolour on the back. It's an interim livery. It's a temporary livery. It was just a, you know, nothing. It's going to be, I think, nothing like what they are going to unleash. So I didn't quite understand why people were so saying this is such a missed opportunity and they could have done so much better. It just seemed lunacy to me, really. So it will be different. I know when I went to the presentation, when they announced the Alpine rebrand in Monza, we had a media chat with Luca Di Meo and Cyril Abiteboul, and we were shown some images of, you know, ideas of what their livery could look like. And it was nothing like what they showed today. It looked, you know, they used the Alpine blue, incorporated the flag much better. So this isn't the final livery. I think the fact it isn't the final livery, it's an interim livery, says all we need about it, really.
Indeed. Luke, what did you think when you saw people getting explosive on Twitter about this temporary livery?
It's F1 Twitter, isn't it? It's just like, let's forget the facts. Let's just go to like our hot opinions and this is what we think and rah, rah, rah. And yeah, I didn't get it. Like, I think it was made quite clear through everything, through all our reports and all of that, that it was just a temporary livery. But I guess just the initial human reaction is you see something go, oh, I don't like it, and then moan about it. And I think that the sort of idea that, oh, has F1 had a livery crisis and things in the past, and is it a very colourful grid and whatever, and I think that ultimately, like, it doesn't matter, because this is not the final livery. Like, I think Alpine, they've been, we've seen through their sports car stuff in recent years, they've always sort of used that nice chrome blue colour, and I think that would be really, really cool, and that would really make the car stand out if they were to go ahead with that for the final design. But yeah, I think we just got to wait and see what the actual livery they announce next month is. I thought it was a very sort of run-of-the-mill press conference, and they were kind of like, okay, well, this is what we're thinking in terms of like adopting the red, white and blue colours of the new logo and stuff they've announced, and people sort of took that and ran with it very quickly, so I didn't really understand that. But yeah, I thought it was also quite interesting that it was an interim livery, and it was just basically a black base with the red, white and blue colours on, and yet they still explained like, oh, there's a reason behind this black base livery. I think it was a hark back to the original Alpine F1 project and something like that, and it's like, just don't worry about it, lads. Just call it, this is how it is for the time being. You'll see the full thing next month, and then I'm sure people will get angry about it again then as well.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you really want to get a ridiculous interim livery, go back and look at what the Neo Formula E team revealed a few years ago. It's making up words to describe colours, basically. That was pretty silly. But yeah, I agree with what you guys said. Although I did think it might have been a slight missed opportunity not to just show the new livery, considering the time of year it is. There's not a lot else happening. Like, I think Aston Martin played a blinder last week in terms of getting coverage for its new sponsor, because they, you know, they put out that teaser image which had the sponsor logo on it really prominently, but everyone else is like, well, it's going to be green again. But so you get people clicking on to read about the new colour scheme, and also you've got their sponsor name lodged into their brains. I thought that was a really clever move, and maybe Alpine could have done a similar thing in terms of, right, let's get the buzz in of what the new F1 car's colours are going to be, and also here's all the other information out of it. But then again, we're already talking about it, so the PR move clearly paid off anyway. But just by getting angry, just by getting mentioned in podcasts and in stories, they've done their job. So fair play to Alpine there, and to Renault and everybody else involved in that announcement. So we shall bring the podcast to a close there. Thank you very much to the two of you for coming on the podcast today, and of course to everybody listening along. Now, just before we go, we'd like to remind you that the latest issue of Autosport magazine came out on Thursday and will be available on the supermarket shelves and in newsagents, as well as on the doormats of subscribers. There'll be a new issue of the magazine for you to pick up every Thursday, packed full of news, analysis and the usual stunning photography. And of course, if you want unlimited access to Autosport from the comfort of your home, visit autosport.com/plus to find out how to subscribe to our digital package. We'll be back soon with another episode of the Autosport podcast. Music is 6 a.m. by Trilo, written by Marcus Simmons. See soundcloud.com/trilomusic.